ది చాప్టర్ ఆన్ కర్మయోగ, స్పెషల్లీ వాట్ ఈజ్ డ్యూటీ. స్వామి వివేకానంద హ్యాస్ డిఫైన్డ్ వన్ ఈజీ వే ఆఫ్ అండర్స్టాండింగ్ వాట్ ఈజ్ డ్యూటీ. దట్ విచ్ టేక్స్ అస్ టు గాడ్, దట్ ఎలోన్ ఈజ్ డ్యూటీ. దట్ విచ్ హెల్ప్స్ అదర్స్ ఆల్సో గో టువర్డ్స్ గాడ్, దట్ ఈజ్ డ్యూటీ. నౌ దిస్ డెఫినేషన్ ఈజ్ very practical for us. Supposing you are in a situation where it seems you may be doing some great harm to other people, you might even be required to kill other people or to beat them or to do something which is not very pleasant, how do you know whether it is really your duty to do it or not? Here is one infallible guide. If it can help both us and also others to go towards God, then that is the duty. Of course, others may not realize it. Supposing there is a terrorist or a rapist, and you know that he is a rapist, you know that he is going to do a lot of harm to other people, what should be your duty? Oh, I am in no way concerned, I have no children, so he is not going to do any harm to me. That's a very bad citizenship. Because if you do not restrain that person, being a citizen of a good country, then you are doing harm positively. It is so difficult to find out what is our duty. But as far as we are concerned, even when we are doing something good for other people, only that particular attitude that I am worshipping God and without any selfish motive, purely with the idea of progressing in spiritual life. If we can perform our duties in that attitude, then that becomes really a duty. We have a perverted idea or definition of duty, as though someone has imposed from outside what we ought to do or should not do. That's not the thing. By our very birth, we are bound. Therefore, we have no way but to do certain things. So when the scriptures or elders tell us that this is your duty, they are not imposing it upon us. They are telling by experience, this is the best way for you to progress further in life. You know, this tradition has a lot of wisdom. Of course, tradition also sometimes becomes meaningless, just a ritual, and sometimes even a harmful ritual. There is a story. In India, you know, they perform a lot of these homas, fire ceremonies. They light up fire and put everything, their saris, gold, of course, ghee, you know, clarified butter, fruits, flowers. I heard in Bangalore there are people who put into the fire a sari costing worth 10,000 rupees. And I get very angry when I hear such things, all blindly in the name of, you know, some religious worship. Instead of spending so much money for that, if they had bought 10 saris and distributed them to the poor people, then they would have been doing a much better work. And pure ghee they pour there. Already enough pollution is there. They are not aware. In South India it is very hot, and yet they go on lighting up fires and pouring, making it even more hot. Anyway, so there was a tradition that every time a fire sacrifice is made, a cat has got to be brought, and right in the middle of the ceremonial place, erect a pole and tie the cat to it. People have seen this being done by those who are experts in performing these things. So in their turn, they also started doing. And if they do not have a cat, they will beg or borrow or steal another cat from somebody and use it. Otherwise, they think all the merit just disappears. There was one intelligent fellow, and he found this very odd. So he went on inquiring why this custom has come. So it so happened, several generations back, there was a famous priest who was famous for performing this kind of fire rituals, and unfortunately he was also very fond of cats. So he had a very pet cat which he loved very much, and whenever he was doing the sacrifice, it will come into the place of worship and make itself a nuisance, and he could not drive it away. So he thought the best thing is to erect a pole and tie it there. It is happy, they are also happy. But people didn't know why he was tying it there. Later on, it was a required item. Without a cat, there would be no merit in the Homa sacrifice. You know, language. In churches, in the former times, they used to use this Latin and Greek and all those languages. How many people understand? The worshippers have absolutely no idea whether the priest is telling that I'm damn tired of this audience, I want to go home, or he's calling on God. Several years back in Bangalore, there was a terrible protest. You know, these local people, they understand only Kannada. They do not understand this Latin and other things. So in a huge mob of Christians, mobbed the bishop's house and said, we don't want this Latin and Greek worship. We want in local language where we can understand. And they took them a lot of persuasion. Then they brought in the change, and now every place in India, practically, they do this in the local language where people can understand. Same thing, when Hindu priests perform these rituals in the temples, they go on uttering Sanskrit mantras. And some of these priests, they are so ignorant, they do not know what is the meaning of Sanskrit words. A famous story goes, you know, there is a famous epic which is very famous in India called Mahabharata. Anyone who wants to read this Mahabharata should recite a salutation to Vyasa, who was the author of this epic. So there is a verse which says, Vyasaya Vishnu Rupaya, Vishnu Rupaya Vyasave. Salutations to Vyasa, the embodiment, the incarnation of Vishnu, and Vishnu, who was another form of Vyasa. In India, people believe all the sacred scriptures have come from God. He is the revealer of every sort of knowledge, especially sacred knowledge. So there was a village priest who was trying to explain the meaning of this verse to ignorant villagers. Vyasaya Vishnu Rupaya. Rupaya means, in our language, a rupee coin. So once Vyasa was in terrible, dire need of 1 rupee, so he ran to Vishnu and borrowed 1 rupee, and after some time Vyasa returned this rupee. This was how the priest was translating this verse into local language. So many people nowadays, they rebel against church authority, temple authority, parental authority, because this tradition, in the name of tradition, they do so many things which are not acceptable at all to the younger people. Even Swami Vivekananda had rebelled against. But blindly to rebel against tradition without understanding the good things in that is also counterproductive. We must be discriminate enough to say what is the local superstition and what is of real value in every religion, in every ritual. One example is, some years back, there was a Muslim leader in Delhi who was contemptuous of the local government. You know, he insulted the Indian national flag, because the government had to warn him that they are going to take action. So it stopped there, fortunately. Otherwise, there could have been a riot. So the point is, a national flag, or Her Majesty's picture on, you know, this notes, currency notes and all that. You see, it is not a symbol of respect to a particular person. It is that which brings unity among all the citizens of the people. a flag is a symbol, a salutation is a symbol. These are kinds of social rituals, and the function of the rituals is to bind all of us together, to unite us together. So, coming back, tradition, there is a lot of wisdom there. So, tradition tells us what to do, what not to do, but we should not blindly swallow it. We should be discriminate in what purpose this particular ritual or tradition has come down, and if it is good, let us follow it. So, coming back to what is the point Swamiji makes, there is a guideline by which we know what is our duty. What is our duty? Really speaking, the only duty of every human being is to go towards God, to manifest the divinity within. Swami Vivekananda defines the essence of Vedanta. Each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest this divinity within by controlling nature, external and internal. The goal of life is to go towards God. What does that mean, going towards God? Is it to worship Rama or Jesus or Buddha? Again, we will have to understand, within each one of us, there is infinite potentiality, capacity for happiness, for goodness, and tremendous amount of capability is there. We can be whatever we like. Of course, not immediately. It needs a great spiritual practice, sadhana we call it. Even if you want to become a musician, you need to practice for several lives together. You cannot become a musician just in one life. It will take several lives. To be perfect in any type of skill or virtue, one needs to spend focus one's life for several lives, and then one will be born. Examples are there. You know, Hinduism believes, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism, these religions believe in reincarnation. This is not the only life. So if you find someone who is extraordinarily talented, you will have to take it for granted that he had practiced tremendous amount of sadhana in that particular field, and here he is enjoying it. Mozart, for example, at the age of 4. So also, there are so many other people are there. The greatest creative people in this world are not created in one life. They must have been practicing or going towards that goal in several lives. So one way to understand God, the definition God is, bring out all the potentialities from within. Even as we are, without too much struggle, we can be very, very happy people. So much of energy is frittered away in being jealous, in thinking of others, in remembering negative thoughts. You know, even scientists, let alone spiritual people, even the psychologists are telling this simple truth, which religions have been telling since infinite time, that do not remember the negative things that happened to you. Last year there was a wonderful article in Time, the Science of Happiness. And one of the things that which contributes towards happiness is that you do not remember the negative things. Remember the positive things, the good things that happened to you. Now, do we do that? We are more often apt to remember only things which are bad, which brought us misery, unhappiness, shame, and all those things. Now, Sri Ramakrishna used to tell people that the person who thinks he is a sinner or he is a wretch, I am a wretch, I am a wretch, I am a wretch, he will turn out a wretch even if he is not a wretch. There is a tremendous power of these words. Words and thought are very closely interrelated. I will come to that subject later on in this topic. But the thing is, even if we pretend to be something which we are not, we are apt to become that by repeating something very bad. There was an instance. There was a fellow, I think he borrowed some money from other people and didn't want to pay, and he was trying to pretend he was mad. Sri Ramakrishna was observing that fellow. Sri Ramakrishna was a supreme psychologist. You must remember, every spiritual person is a supreme psychologist. All spirituality is understanding the mind and controlling it. So Sri Ramakrishna observed that in the beginning he was only pretending to other people. Slowly later on, he was exhibiting real symptoms of madness. So before it went very far, Sri Ramakrishna called him and said, "Look here, if you go on doing this, you are going to be really mad. Better you pay off a little money to that fellow and then be a normal man. Otherwise you will go to Harley Street and go on paying whole life." You know, there was this psychologist and he was very famous. He amassed lots of money and he thought it is time to enjoy. And fortunately his son also had trained himself to be a psychologist. So one day the father called the son and said, "Son, I worked for a long time. I want to enjoy a retired life. Here are the keys for our surgery, and now you take over and you look after it." So morning he handed over the keys, and evening the son came back in high glee. "Daddy, Daddy, do you know that woman whom you have been treating for last 50 years? I have cured her in one day." Father bent his head, forehead, and said, "Stupid fellow, what have you done? All this house, car, and everything is because of her." If you cure everybody like that, then you are not going to get money. You have to keep them there. So you see, many of us could be much, much more happy than what we are now by repeating good words. That is the meaning of mantra. When we are given mantra by a guru, usually it is name of God. But what do you think of when you are repeating God's name? What are your feelings? You are supposed to develop happiness, contentment, peacefulness, forbearance, and all those things. Then only the mantra really brings out the tremendous potentialities from within us. It is to teach us this lesson that these great souls like Ramakrishna, Sharada Devi, Swami Vivekananda, Christ, Buddha, and all these great people, they are not only great spiritual realized souls, their lives are also great examples for us. You know, there is a wonderful book called Imitation of Christ. So what does it talk about? The teachings of Christ are very well known. But in day-to-day life, how do we apply these teachings of Jesus Christ so that we can become better people? It's a wonderful book. I'm sure many of you had a glimpse of it, but I would advise you to go through it, Imitation of Christ. So also, Imitation of Buddha or Imitation of Holy Mother. You know the famous teaching of Holy Mother? Every day we chant it during lunch time. "Please accept this offering and bless us. May we not complain or find fault with others. May we find our own faults. May we make the whole world our own." Holy Mother's teaching, there are two types of teachings. One type of teaching is about the goal. This is the ultimate goal of life. The other type of teaching is how we can progress towards that goal by slowly transforming our life. That is where all these teachings come into play. So, coming back to our subject, Swami Vivekananda says in this chapter called "What is Duty?" Says duty is seldom sweet. Its love has to grease the wheels of duty. Then only the wheels run smoothly. But what does it mean to love? He says forbearance is one of the greatest qualities we have to learn in life. And it is absolutely marvelous statement. It's very easy to say, I love. You know, what is the problem? When a man, young man and young woman come together, they are attracted towards each other. And many times they love each other really, nicely. But after marriage, the problems start. Why does it happen like that? Is there something wrong with their love? There is something wrong, in a way of speaking. What is that? This love is not strong enough to bring about forbearance. You know, it is very easy when two people, you know, they meet in a park or in a hotel to love each other very nicely. But to be living 24 hours in the same house, and then, you know, every person has his or her own certain types of behavior. Even sometimes, it is not necessary they should have bad qualities, but their very particular behavior irritates other people. For example, you know, so we had a problem here. So there were two people staying in a room. So one fellow cannot bear the warmth, so he wants to throw open all the windows. The other fellow cannot bear at all the slightest amount of cold. He wants to tightly close. Now that's a very big subject, you know. So a wise man had been asked, who was living nearby. He was a neighbor. So the neighbor said, you know, that first of all, you open all the doors and windows. And the fellow who can't bear the cold, he will die. Throw him out. After that, close all the doors and windows. And the fellow who can't bear the warmth, he will die. Then we will go and occupy that room. You know, these small things, some people like particular type of way of eating food. Some people do not like it. These are not bad qualities. These are peculiarities of likes and dislikes. There are, of course, also people with very bad qualities. But this love has not foreseen. Love means forbearance. Love means to put up with each other and see them in a good light. That part of the love that we have not learned yet to get. There is nothing wrong, really, in loving each other. But it is not enough if everything you come according to, dressed according to my taste, you cook food according to my taste, and you behave according to my liking, then there is nothing that I should do. But that will not happen. In this world, everybody dresses differently, speaks differently, thinks differently. We have to put up with that. If the love doesn't bring about this quality of forbearance, then very soon there is going to be trouble between nations, between individuals, between two religions, between two languages, between two cultures. Cultural clash, religious clash, national clash, international clash. What is all this? Everybody is good, but the love doesn't understand that forbearance is the only test of love. So Swamiji goes on from this point. Life is there to teach us forbearance, because life doesn't go according to our wishes. It goes, it has its own life. Everything is going on nicely, and suddenly there is an earthquake. And all, maybe the family members have gone. You know, every day we are getting this news. You know that the ship in Egypt had drowned. 1,000 people died just 2 days back. Who imagined that such a thing is going on? Probably people are going, I will meet my wife, my children, I will be very happy, or I will earn some more money. Everybody has some expectations. But life doesn't work that way. And this, what is the greatest tragedy in these things? It is purely man-made. what is man-made, according to the news, you know, that there was a fire even before the ship started. And the captain did not heed. He said, oh, it is only a minor problem. We will sort it out on the way. And then on the way it became a bigger problem. This is what, anyway, I am only giving an example. It may not be correct. But the point is, even if the man is very cautious, very intelligent, took all the trouble, there is no guarantee that this thing would not happen. Accidents can happen. So what is the reason for that? The reason is, there is somebody who is running the universe, the circus, and he has his own script. And unfortunately, we do not know the script. So we expect something, we think in a different way. When suddenly unexpected things happen, we have no capacity to put up with it. So in marriage, or outside marriage, in the office, most of the clashes come, not because there is a tremendous amount of badness in people. Small things, what we call, you know, ego clashes. Sometimes there is nothing but just ego clash. So, life teaches us forbearance. And if we do not develop it, we will have to undergo through this misery for a long, long, long time. And there is no holiday until we learn that lesson. Nature will repeat that lesson for us in various forms. And of all the people, according to Swami Vivekananda, that a mother is the highest embodiment of forbearance. How much the mother, especially the mother, she puts up with the children's, you know, right from the conception. And even towards till the fellow dies also sometimes. If the old mother has to cook, he would not do anything. Anyway, parents undergo a tremendous amount of trouble for the sake of their children. And it is good, very good, because nature is teaching us how to put up with life. The only problem is, we should not only be forbearing only towards our children. That forbearance quality must be extended to the whole universe. I will give you one or two examples. You know, Holy Mother, Sharada Devi, she was having a big household. And Holy Mother is considered the very embodiment of patience. How many people, in how many ways, they mistreat her, they misuse her. Of course, she was very happy, you know, whenever devotees go, she would cook as a mother. But sometimes people also used to do nuisance and pain, give her pain, etc. There was one devotee, and he came to Jairambati, and he stayed and ate nicely and happily and stayed for a few days, and he was returning. So while returning, you know, we make our pranams, what you call salutations. So this fellow was taking leave. He bent down and with his stony head, and thumped against her toe. And mother's body was very, very delicate, like Sri Ramakrishna. She cried out, like that in pain. But what to do if somebody is making pranams and beating the head against it? What will you do? So mother asked, why did you do that, my son? He said, mother, you have so many devotees. The moment my back is turned, you will forget me. So I am making sure you will remember me as long as pain is there. Mother had to laugh and say, oh, what a wonderful way of making me remember you. There was a cat. And you know, Hindus have got this idea that no animal should touch the milk or sweets or fruits or things before it is offered to God. And Sri Ramakrishna was so particular. It's very interesting, you know, why this concept has come. There was a devotee called Ramchandra Datta. One day he was bringing some jalebis to Sri Ramakrishna. On the way, he saw a poor boy, and he felt pity and just took out one and gave it to him. And he came to Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna could not touch, and Ramchandra Datta didn't say what happened on the way. But Sri Ramakrishna knows everything, you see. He told Ram, whenever you bring something here, by here he means to him, do not give it to anybody. That's what I also tell to devotees. Don't give it to anybody, just bring it straight to me. Do not give it to anybody, because I offer everything to Mother, and I cannot offer something which has been given away to some people. This is one instance. Another instance was there, you know, he had his spiritual son, Swami Brahmananda Rakhalma. One day, somebody brought some sweet meat or something, I do not remember, and Rakhal Maharaj happened to breathe very hard over it. Here people eat, you know, they like that, they go on smelling. That's considered to be unusable, cannot be offered to God. You cannot even smell. Of course, those who cook in the kitchen, I do not know what they are going to do. The idea is that it has to be offered to God. So, you know, this cat, what does it know about these rules, human rules and regulations? There was milk, it only knew that there was food. So it went and then started licking a little bit, and the disciple got very angry and then bit it and then tried to throw it away. Holy Mother called the boy and said, "My son, I also live in that cat. Do not beat it." That was enough, because if she is living in that cat, any injury to that cat means injuring Holy Mother. But apart from that, she told common sensical thing. You see, it is cat. And what is cat's nature? Cat's nature is wherever there is food. What is children's nature? You know, here I have seen on celebrations day, the children go on looking at all the nice there offerings there. Did you notice, I didn't mention grown-up people. But it did not mean that grown-up people were not looking at it. Only they are, you know, they keep mum, that's all. It's the nature of the animals to kill. They are not cruel. It's not the nature of, it is the nature of cat to eat food. It is the nature of small children. So, this is the idea we must have if we want to develop forbearance. Suppose somebody is there, he is misbehaving. Why is he doing? Maybe it has become a habit with him. Maybe he doesn't mean anything, but even if he means something, but that is his habit. What control have you got? Can you change his nature? You cannot. Sometimes we have to put up. Suppose you say, "No, I won't put up. It is my divine right to defend myself and all that." Who will be disturbed? You will be disturbed. With this kind of mind, do you think you will be able to do any good? If an angry housewife goes and cooks, do you think the food will be tasty? If a husband is very angry, do you think he would be able to love his children? Life teaches us forbearance, we have to put up. But more than that, there is a philosophy behind this idea of forbearance. What is it? If I am experiencing, and notice it, when we are talking about forbearance, we never talk about good things. You know, you may be getting good promotion, you may be getting good things to eat, or lot of money. Do you need forbearance at that time? Yes, you do need. What is that forbearance? Don't get excited. Don't cut capers with joy. Because that which goes up also comes down. Do you know that story? There was a priest and a rabbi, and they had a problem. They were intimate friends, but they had a problem. Or rather, the priest had a problem. What was the problem? You know, after the talk, his sermon is over, hat collection. And hat collection, now the moral problem is how much the priest should give to church and keep for himself. So the priest went and consulted his friend Rabbi. And Rabbi said, We have no such problem. We solved these problems long back. Then the Rabbi asked, "What do you do after getting the collection?" He said, "You know, after everybody goes away, I draw a circle, stand in the middle of the circle and throw the money. Whatever falls within the circle I take, whatever falls outside the circle, then I will give it to church. But most of the money falls outside the circle only. I get very little. That is why I have come to consult you. And how do you solve that problem? The rabbi said, we have no problem at any time. I completely give everything to God. I stand and look up and say, oh God, here is your money. Take what you want and what you don't want. Throw it down. So if we are at any time excited because of good news, good fortune or things that are happening, there will also come a time when things will change. And if things change, have you got the courage, the power to withstand it? That is why under all circumstances, some kind of balance is to be kept. That is called forbearance. That is called yoga. That is why Sri Krishna says in the Gita, Sukha dukhe same kritva, labha labhav jaya jaya. In pleasure and pain, in victory and in defeat, in profit and in loss, keep your mind balanced. Samatvam yoga uchyate, balance is called yoga or spirituality. Life teaches us, and after some time, we learn that in life there is very little in our control. There is somebody else who is directing the whole drama. Therefore, what is our part? Our part is to play to the best of our ability. And mother is the highest embodiment of this forbearance. So Swami Vivekananda goes on saying, the position of the mother is the highest in the world, as it is the one place in which to learn and exercise the greatest unselfishness. The love of God is the only love that is higher than a mother's love. All others are lower. That is why mother is given the highest respect in the Eastern religions, whether it is India or China or Japan. Mother is given the highest respect. Matru Devo Bhava, let your mother be your God. But no woman who is unchaste can ever become a step into the place of a mother. That is why chastity is the precondition of good motherhood. No man or no woman who is not chaste, they can be good parents to their children. And you know, parents exert tremendous amount of influence upon their children. Even though Hindu Vedanta believes that every one of us are born, it is not because of our parents that we acquire what we have. We are already like seeds, but parents are like fields. If the field is good, the seed has good opportunity to grow. If the field is bad, then the seed has less opportunity. But every seed is not the same seed. Some are good seeds, some are bad seeds. But having given all that, the question is, what is the influence of nurture? There is a great debate going on between nature and nurture. So we are all born as nature, but nurture also plays a great role. That is where the household, where the parents are good, the parents are pious, the parents are loving, the parents are forbearing, hardworking, disciplined, and loving each other, cooperating. There, the children have a greater opportunity to develop those particular qualities. And where this is lacking, the children will be, inevitably they will suffer. Of course, the parents themselves would suffer. So, the Hindu psychology had learnt it long back. Chastity is the secret of becoming a good mother, becoming a good father. Now, what is chastity? It is a question, again, which confuses a lot of people. There is, of course, the most important point in this chastity is sexual faithfulness, chastity. But that alone will not do. Chastity is not merely, otherwise every castrated bull must be a great yogi. Or every householder who has produced children must be a great worldly person. Or every monk who is not married must be a great spiritual person. No, there is no such rule. There are householders who have children but who are the greatest spiritual personalities. Example, Sri Ramakrishna's parents, Sridharam and Chandramani Devi. They had four or five children, but they are considered to be the greatest spiritual personalities of those times. So what is chastity? Chastity is devotion to one particular ideal. If a scientist is chaste, then he will devote his whole mind towards his scientific field. If a priest is devoted to worship, then he will focus all his life only to that. If a musician is only focusing on the art of music, then he will be a chaste person. So chastity, sexual chastity helps us, because there is a lot of power there, though I will not go into that subject here. But the other idea of chastity is singleness of mind. Focus on one particular field. Be devoted to it. Whether you are a Christian or a Hindu or whatever you are, you be devoted to your own religion, minus the fanaticism, minus all the bad things that are there. Be a sincere person. Chastity is the greatest virtue. A father who is totally devoted to the wife and children. A mother similarly devoted to her husband and to her children and to family. They would be able to contribute greatly to the inner growth of their children. And where this is looseness is there, where there is unfaithfulness is there, the parents themselves suffer, and the children are also, they also will suffer. Only a woman who observes chastity, and also a husband who observes chastity, only they will step into the next stage, which is that they will become the fit parents. A mother is not simply bearing children, not simply cooking and feeding the children, not simply providing some opportunities for the children to go to school and learn some art. The responsibility of the parents is too great. It is to show them what is life. It is for this purpose, in the olden times, in India, and even in Europe, you know, the children used to be taught by the priests. They used to go to the church. Why? Because the priests are dedicated people to God, and they were very strict disciplinarians. They themselves observed the greatest, what is called, disciplines. So to learn how to formulate a character, how to be a person of great good character, that is the responsibility of teachers, that is the responsibility of parents, and that is where the difference lies between good parents and bad parents. It is not merely providing a little bit of food. Why is this so important? It is important because, you see, even the moment you hear the word character, oh, that is such a hard thing to achieve. I just want to be an ordinary person. I don't want to be a person of character. But I want to be a happy person. No. Happiness is directly connected with character. A person, the greater the character, the greater is the happiness. We have yet to understand the difference between, or the relationship between, character and happiness. Of course, all of us want to be happy. But where will you get happiness? How will you get happiness unless you are a person of character? So why is this so? In brief, character is that which allows our real nature to shine forth. And our real nature is of the nature of ananda, sachidananda. Therefore, the man or woman of great character is one who just let the happiness flow freely from within. Happiness cannot be obtained from outside. Swami Vivekananda concludes this chapter, what is duty. The point we have to understand here is, unless we perform the duties which are right in front of us properly, with the right attitude, we cannot progress into the higher position. Next. So that is why Hinduism divides life into four stages: the stage of learning, and the stage of living in this world, practicing what we have learned, the stage of gradually withdrawing from the world, and the last stage of giving up all attachment to the world and becoming a monk or a nun. These are the four stages. But let no person think, I will choose what I want to be, and then immediately say, I want to become a monk or nun. Unless a person is a good householder, he can never become a good monk or a nun. It's impossible. It is a very natural progression. Of course, you will see some people who have renounced the world at very young age and become monks or nuns. How do you explain that? Of course, Hinduism has every explanation. That is why it is the greatest religion on earth, you see. It has answers for everything. It says, you know, in past birth, the person must have been a good householder, and that is why they have become monks now. Upanishads use a wonderful word. Mahashali, a great householder. Mahashali. Only Mahashali is a great householder. He only is his next step, stage of evolution is to become a monk or a nun. So this is what is called Peter's principle. In simple psychological truth, have you heard about Peter's principle? No man can rise beyond the position for which he is unfit to occupy. A man goes on rising because he is fit, and he reaches a stage where he becomes incapable, and there he gets stuck. This is the simple principle Swamiji is telling, that student's life, householder's life, and retirement life, and renunciant's life, these are progressive things. You cannot choose them, but you pass into them very naturally. If you do not do that, then you will have to learn this lesson. This principle is illustrated by Swami Vivekananda through a story from Mahabharata. I will tell you briefly, there was a young Brahmin monk, and he went away very early, renounced the world, went away to a forest and performed hard austerities for several years. He used to live by begging in the nearby village. So one day he was deeply meditating, and under a tree, suddenly there was a crow had dropped its filth on his head. Of course, the crow did not want to disturb him. It just did it naturally. Unfortunately, he happened to be, you know, like this, a thief was caught and taken to the magistrate. What was his crime? He stole a goat. So the magistrate asked him, Do you plead guilty? Have you stolen the goat? He said, No, Your Honor. I just happened to steal the rope, but unfortunate that a goat was tied at the end of the rope. So magistrate said, that is fair enough. Since you only stole the rope, let this fellow's hand be taken and put for 6 months in the jail. Of course, you know, unfortunately the whole body was also tied to the hand. But this fellow was very clever. He said, all right, I had an accident and an artificial hand. You can take this and in the jail. So the crow dropped its filth there, and the Brahmin became very annoyed. He looked up angrily up, and instantaneously the crow was burnt to ashes. And the Brahmin ascetic felt very proud. Ah, what a great power I have achieved. And he was feeling very smug and self-satisfied. So he went to the village to beg. He stood in front of a house and shouted, Mother, give me alms. That is what we call in India, you know. Mother Annapurna, give me bhiksha. So there was a young housewife, and she gently replied from inside, "My son, I am serving at this moment my husband, and as soon as I finish, I will come and give you alms. Please wait." The monk heard it, and he furious thoughts, "I am a monk with such a tremendous power. What does this wretched woman think of herself? She is making me wait." He was only thinking like that. From inside came, "My son, I am not a crow that you can burn by your looks." The monk was surprised. How did she know what happened in the forest? Anyway, he waited. After some time, the young woman came and gave the alms. The monk asked, "Mother, how did you know what happened in the forest?" She said, "I have not practiced any austerities. I am a married woman. I am totally devoted to my husband. My husband is sick. I am serving him to the best of my capacity. I look upon him as my only God. So by doing my duty in this way of worshipping, I acquired all the illumination. I know what is happening to everybody anywhere." And then further she said, "You are not perfect, and you will never be perfect in this way. Go to that village, and there is a person, and he will teach you how to become perfect." So by this time, the monk was convinced. He goes to the next village and inquires of the person, and he was told he is in the market cutting up animals and selling them. He is a butcher. So the monk felt very much disgusted. "What? I, a Brahmin monk, to learn about spirituality from a butcher?" So anyway, he went there, and as soon as the butcher saw him, "Oh, that young wife, she sent you to me, is it not?" The monk was shocked. Here even the butcher was reading what was happening. He waited, and after the butcher finished his work, and he said, "Come with me to my home," and made him sit. He said, "Please wait, I have my old parents. First I will serve them, cook the food, bathe them, feed them, and serve them. Then I will be free to meet you." And he did that, and the young monk was waiting patiently. Then there is a beautiful, very elevating conversation. It is called Vyadha Gita in Mahabharata. The holy butcher's conversation. Anyway, the point he told is, "I am a householder. My parents are there. I have to serve them, and I consider, look upon them as my gods. So I do my best to serve them, and it is my duty to earn my livelihood. I have been unfortunately born as a butcher in a butcher's family, but I do not consider it as a lowly work. I consider it as worship of God. And just by merely doing my work as worship, I have attained this state of illumination." Then the butcher advises the young ascetic that, "Go back. Your parents are suffering. No one is there to look after them. And here you are sitting and then doing your stupid austerities. You are never going to be spiritually progressive in this way." And the Brahmin, he went back, served his parents, and came back. What is this whole point of the story? Story is evolution, whether in the world or in spiritual life, can only happen very naturally by passing the previous stage in its entire way, not by short-circuiting it, not by jumping over it, not by escaping over it. Evolution should be a very natural process. Nobody can jump out of this evolutionary queue, unfortunately. So, the whole chapter, Swamiji ends and saying that whatever your duties, whatever place you are, whatever job you are doing, whatever may be the circumstances, consider that God has placed you under those circumstances. Do what best you can, pray to God, offer the results to Him, and remain calm and quiet. Concluding this, he says that Swami Vivekananda met a great yogi called Pavahari Baba. And Swamiji asked him, give me some advice. And this Pauhari Baba gives him one advice. What is it? That make the end your means. Make your means the end. Supposing you have to do, you achieve some goal. Then forget about the goal. Once you set the goal, then pay all attention to the means. Suppose, for example, you want to go to, say, Ireland. And you are going in a car. Your destiny is to go to Ireland. But don't go on thinking about Ireland. Once you start the journey, pay attention to what is happening every moment. That way, you will have less amount of accidents or problems. You will reach quicker enough. So, Pauhari Baba's advice, Swamiji liked very much. So, he used to say, whatever you are doing, pay all the attention as though that is the highest spiritual practice you have to do. There was Swami Brahmananda, one of the greatest spiritual giants. He was the president. And there was a devotee called Boshishen. He was also a scientist. And Swami Brahmananda used to smoke hookah. So once Swami Brahmananda told, Boshi, prepare hookah. I want to smoke. And then this young boy, he had prepared it and he brought it. Swami Brahmananda took one puff and he was highly pleased because it was just the right way to do it. Said, Boshi, one more time you prepare hookah like this for me and I will make you my disciple, a monk. Of course, what he meant to say, anybody who can do that, he would also become a great man. So, let us do our duty, whatever our duty. What is our duty right now? For example, here, it is my duty to speak well. It is your duty to listen well, to remember what I have spoken, and to see how it, whether it is rational, irrational, and how it can be applied to day-to-day life. Then I will be blessed, you will be blessed, and there will be less trouble. That is why this invocation, you know, may there not be any clash between the teacher and the students. Let there be unity, harmony of thought and actions. We will discuss further these wonderful subjects in our next class next week. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.